Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In the new thriller End of October from the Pulitzer Prize winner and bestselling author Lawrence Wright, Dr. Henry Parsons, an unlikely but appealing hero, races to find the origins and cure of a mysterious new killer virus as it brings the world to its knees. The novel has a virus that starts in Asia, sweeps across continents, cripples the healthcare system, wrecks the economy, and kills scores of people worldwide. Yes, eerily prescient. Lawrence Wright is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, screenwriter, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and fellow at the Center for Law and Security at the New York University School of Law. It's a great pleasure to welcome Lawrence Wright to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Joe.
What led you in the first place to want to write a novel about a pandemic?
The idea originated a decade ago when Ridley Scott, the filmmaker, wanted me to write a screenplay. He had read Cormac McCarthy's novel, The Road, which is, father and son wandering through the ruins of civilization.
Right.
And his question was, well, what happened? Cormac didn't bother to to say. It was an interesting challenge. What force or event would be so powerful that it would cause civilization to crack? And nuclear war was a possibility. But, you know, it's very difficult to find heroes in such a scenario. And as a young reporter, I had done some stories out of the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, and I met a lot of epidemiologists and microbiologists and virologists, and I just thought, these people are remarkable. They're brilliant, they're brave, they go off into places that I would be terrified. These hot zones where novel diseases are cooked up. To me, they are heroes. And so I thought it would be more interesting to set it in that environment. And Ridley never made the movie, but I never forgot the idea. And a few years ago, I decided I would return to it and do the research I should have done the first time around.
I want to talk about that research in a second. I mean, obviously, a lot has been made and should be made about how, as I said in the introduction, how prescient this novel is. I should say, however, your novel, things turn out so much worse than where we are right now.
Yeah.
So that's good, right?
Yeah, one of my reviewers said it was consoling. So I'm happy she feels that way.
Well, it is somewhat consoling in the fact that you have a person like Dr. Henry Parsons, who is in and out in this novel as far as being at the helm, but who knows what he's doing. And
yeah.
I did wonder, as I was reading the novel, as to the parallels. Like, who is, in our current situation, who is the Henry Parsons?
Well, you know, there were a number of people that I talked to, and I borrowed qualities from them. The epidemiologist, I had a lot of friends, a lot of sources back when I was young who were in, the epidemic intelligence service. And I set Henry in that world. His particular qualities there, there's this sort of intuitive genius that he has. And several of the people that are sources for this novel are like that. They're the people right now who are developing the vaccines that are in human trials. I feel so grateful that they had time for me back in those days when I was asking them for help. But, when I would get into paint myself into a corner, I'd have my hero. He has to solve this, scientific problem with all these constraints on him. And I would ask my sources, here's the situation. And they were delighted because essentially the qualities that imbue Henry, curiosity. Courage, curiosity, and a mind that kindles to puzzles. Most of these epidemiologists are are problem solvers. They like riddles, and every disease is a puzzle. So, you know, the disease I concocted in the novel, they made it more real and more difficult to solve as a puzzle. And it was, you know, in some respects, I get more credit than I deserve because so much of the intellectual work was done by those sources of mine.
The vocabulary, the language, the terms that you use in the book, probably 6 months ago would have been foreign to most readers, and now we're very familiar with them, including just coronavirus, right? I mean, that in and of itself is interesting.
Oh, yeah, and there's a section in the book where I talk about SARS.
Yes.
And we're so fortunate that it is COVID that we're facing and not SARS. You know, SARS killed about 10% of all the people that it infected. And it was in 2003 when we had the outbreak, and it was an amazing feat of the public health establishment worldwide to stop that contagion within 150 days. It's just a triumph of public health, and it's unappreciated and practically forgotten by most people, I suppose. But the pandemic that we're in now could have been in 2003 with a far more fatal disease.
In the novel, it is called Congoli virus, and the first half of the book, roughly the first half, is what is so eerily similar to what we're dealing with right now. And you point out that the parallels with what's actually happening, that's not coincidental.
No, it's not. Because, you know, it's not just the experts I talked to. There were all these tabletop exercises, Joe. Almost every year there would be one at Johns Hopkins or somewhere where they'd lay out a scenario where a novel virus had suddenly appeared. And then what do we do? And they would have, you know, the head of CDC, they would have administration officials, you know, the real people. You know, they would throw them these problems. And, you know, now what do you do? And you know, these scenarios were extremely useful to me. But also there was, you know, plenty of other research that I could draw upon so that I could make it as plausible as it is. The other thing I think that maybe readers don't realize, the virus that I concocted is an influenza. But it's really built on the 1918 Spanish flu.
Right.
It's different in its physical qualities, but in terms of its effect, the progress of the disease in 1918 is essentially the course that my disease takes. And so in the calendar, you know, there's 1918 coming in the early spring. It happens also in the novel. It happens, you know, it's happening now. You know, where we are faced in February and March with a tremendously contagious disease that sweeps through the world. You know, in the novel, it turns out rather bleakly, as it did in 1918, because when the second wave hit in the fall, October remained the most fatal month in American history.
In the creation of the novel and what was going to happen, so where does the extrapolation begin of, okay, well, if this happens, which is very realistic, this is very real, this could happen. When did you start to say, okay, this is where I'm on firm novelistic territory?
Well, my approach, you know, I'm, you know, a journalist by training. And so, you know, normally I ask what happened. And in this case, I asked myself what could happen. The process is not that different. If you do all this research, and there are a lot of people who have been asking that question themselves their entire career, you know, you get an image of how things can happen. And then on top of that, I look at the world as it is, with all the fractures and the partisan rivalries and, you know, everything that's going on in the world, and I just add stress. And the pandemic is a stressor. What would happen geopolitically. And there are parts of the novel that haven't come true, and I sincerely pray that they never do, but they could. Looking at the blame game that's going on right now between China and the US and Russia's attempts to undermine our democracy and all of these things, this ongoing Islamic civil war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, all of those things are at play in the world. And I don't think that the geopolitical fallout has entirely happened.
You write at the very beginning of the novel, you introduce a term called viral sovereignty, which is fascinating, where countries are latching on to the concept of owning patents on indigenous diseases.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I started it off in Indonesia, because Indonesia was the place where one dangerous flu arose, an avian influenza. And what happens in that situation is that scientists rush in, they try to analyze it, and then immediately try to figure out how to make a vaccine, all the things that you're seeing right now. But the Indonesian authorities withheld some of the information about it, and they demanded to have some kind of ownership over the virus as if it were a natural resource like oil or gold. And it really bollocksed up the process. And so it took a lot of negotiation and some concessions so that scientists would be free to address a new virus as it comes out, no matter where it is in the world.
Indonesia, you write, Indonesia made the case that other countries would exploit the virus to formulate vaccines that Indonesia could not afford. And also you have Henry arguing that withholding data is just insane, which also comes to play in what we're seeing now, where we're seeing it in nations and countries, but also individual states.
Yeah, it's you would think that an event like this, where we're all in danger, that there would be a source of unity. The world would come together, the country would come together. But what we're seeing, unfortunately, is more divisions, more rivalries. And there's everybody. It's so striking to me that from the World Health Organization down to individual countries, down to individual states, down to cities and counties, everybody's improvising. And there are elaborate, carefully laid out plans for how to handle a pandemic. And the administration had them handed off to them, a very carefully thought out program, but apparently it just fell through the cracks. And each state has been kind of left to its own devices. I live in Texas, and we're essentially wide open. Bars open tomorrow. So, it's unnerving because there's a sense that it's not being driven by expertise. It's being driven by other factors, political factors.
Lawrence Wright is our guest. His new novel is The End of October. It is published by Knopf. There's one point late in the novel where you have the new president in your novel is sheltering in place and releases this. This is when all hell is breaking loose. Releases a statement that stores would soon be open, the baseball season would resume, and as you write, all lies, as everyone knew but respectfully reported. Are we in that case now where a lot of it is just wishful thinking?
If it just stops at wishful thinking, it will be okay. I'm worried about the idea of resuming mass events in particular, and reopening the stadiums. It's one thing to have the teams playing, but it's another thing to bring the fans into the stand. political conventions. This is a real challenge to our democracy. How do you campaign? How do you even vote? This is a big political issue about voting by mail and so on. But all of those things, if you drop all caution, this virus would just flare up and consume us. That's what it wants to do. It's the only reason that we've been able to hold it at bay as well as we have is because of the sacrifice of individuals to shelter themselves in their houses. It's such an enormous personal cost.
Lawrence Wright is our guest. The name of the new novel is The End of October. It is published by Knopf. The idea in the book, you get so specific as far as the science, of course. When you're dealing with the various government agencies, it becomes a little more vague. You refer to the State Department just as state or as defense, even vice president and president. And yet, they fit their descriptors.
Well, I had the idea, I wanted it to be set in now. I didn't want it to really, I didn't want it to be seen as a political diatribe. And yet I wanted it to be realistic, to make it feel like we're in the world that we actually inhabit. And that's why some of the characters are actually real people. Mm. And some other characters resemble real people, but they're not meant to be them. I didn't put their names on it for a reason.
The idea that it is the vice president that takes over this effort, really, we of course see that. Is that, again, I assume not a coincidence?
Well, it was a lucky guess. I figured, this is the kind of sticky political problem that a president wouldn't want to own. And so, the easiest thing to do is hand it off to a vice president who doesn't have very much else to do.
This was not on my list, but I have to wonder about it. If you wrote a novel like this, if your novel included a section where the president was taking a drug that everybody said wasn't good for you for that purpose or was not safe, or whether it be about just asking the question about bleach and disinfectants. You would be reviewed harshly, would you not?
Well, people give me too much credit for knowing what was going to happen. I mean, I talked to experts and so on, but then there's the sort of fortuitousness of some of the things that I came up with, and I don't. If certainly it would be true if I had the president taking hydroxychloroquine, it would be uncanny. So fortunately, I did not do that.
But just this idea of what our reality often is mirroring is sometimes it rivals your job as a fiction writer, right? I mean,
oh yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I find that there are so many things that have outrun my own imagination. And I'm glad I'm not trying to write this novel after the COVID experience, because it would be hard to match it.
I was fascinated because I will say that I was a little leery of reading a book like this during the pandemic, but I'm so glad that I did, because it is so filled with information. Learning about the viruses that come out of the seawater in just a liter bottle of and also that the viruses are what helped us evolve and give us a smell and taste and touch. It's fascinating, that history, and it helps you become better informed.
Yeah, I just loved writing about that stuff. I the viral world was such a mystery, and it is a mystery. I mean, there are trillions of viruses, and we don't know anything about them. But the lore and the science around it, I was totally captivated by it. And because I'm the kind of person I am, I'm essentially I like plunging into worlds that I don't know about. And trying to understand them, and then trying to imagine the people that inhabit them. That world was particularly interesting to me, and I feel a little nostalgic for the experience I had in researching it and writing it.
When it comes to research, I assume you wanted to spend time with the CDC.
Yeah, I did.
What
Because my
happened?
hero works at the CDC, and well, I called and called, and I could never get anybody to return my call or set up any kind of appointments, and I was on my way to Georgia anyway to go to a submarine base to tour a nuclear submarine. So it was ironic that I could get into this super secret military base, but going to the CDC, which is one of its functions is to communicate about health to the public, I found that totally bizarre.
As you mentioned, you had worked with the CDC in the past, so do you have any sense of what the issue was?
No, I guess it just struck me as rank incompetence, honestly, because in calling. Identifying yourself as a member of the press, you've got a legitimate interest. That's part of their job is to communicate. And so I don't know. I found it odd. I don't want to take personal offense at it, but it just was an early, it was, it struck a strange note to me because I revered the CDC. It has been a great institution in the past. It's a world standard, of healthcare and public health. And, so it just seemed like something was off. And so anyway, I'm heartbroken by how badly the CDC has stumbled in this COVID crisis that we're in.
As you mentioned, your hero is Henry Parsons, who's an epidemiologist at the CDC. So, how do you fill in the blanks then for you in the research?
Well, I went to the Fort Detrick and National Institutes of Health, the National Institute of Allergies and Immune Diseases. I spent a lot of time talking to experts and also in private industry, the chief scientist at Pfizer, who is in charge of their COVID vaccine right now. So people that were on the ground who are actually, doing the kind of work and research that my hero does, those are the people I wanted to talk to.
You mentioned the nuclear submarine a few moments ago, but that's a major part of this book too. What was it like to research that, to
It was
spend the
fun.
time that, like Henry does, on this sub?
Well, it's the nice thing about being a journalist or a writer of any sort, I guess, is you have this passport to go to places that people don't normally get to. And I had invented the idea that my hero would have to be on a submarine. And I'd never been on a submarine myself. And so, it turned out the Navy was delightful. Once this was cleared, I got to interview maybe 15 people at the base. They were I went on the USS Tennessee, which was one of the boomers, as they call them. We have 14 in our fleet. And each of them is equipped to carry 24 intercontinental missiles with 8 warheads on each. And one of these submarines can essentially almost destroy the whole world. It's just incredible the amount of firepower that is on this. And these missiles are 40 feet tall, Joe. They're, it's sort of hard to take into your mind how massive this whole thing is. And when I was on board, they were doing a test, and I was in the targeting room where I hope the sanest people in the world are. But they said that they were doing this test, and you know, I asked to see the button, and it's attached to what looks like a pistol grip and some coiled wire, and the question was, would you like to push the button? the weight of the, you know, I said, are you sure that this is, you know, not attached to anything that would go off? And oh yeah, we were just in this test mode. So we're still here, so I suppose it was safe.
You have a scene in the book, I believe it's the captain who is when you're on land, is showing you the warheads that would be on the various subs.
Yeah.
And or is showing Henry. And I assume that was shown to you very similarly.
Oh, yeah. 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 I was taken around, and I just, you know, I came out of that that base just full of gratitude for the service that all these people are doing, and also intrigued by the world that they inhabit. This submarine world is very interesting culture. It's extremely sophisticated. God knows it's dangerous. And also the moral responsibility that is required when you step onto that submarine, and your mission, if you're ever called upon to exercise it, is so catastrophic. You know, it really, you know, I thought this is one of those places where, as a human being, you don't want to be. On the other hand, you know, in terms of protecting us, it's, you know, I think these people are probably as good Americans as you could possibly find.
Well, Lawrence Wright's new novel is End of October. It is published by Knopf. Lawrence, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
It's been fun talking to you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.